This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. As you'll be aware, we build the Scotland Outdoors podcast out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. Now, this week, we had all sorts of stuff. Slow worms, skiffs, and possibly the oddest rendition of a Deep Purple classic I've ever heard. OK, I'm going to give you a quick tree update. The cherry blossom is out, which is, you might expect this time of year, what have you. But the rowan tree, the leaves have come out on that, and there is just a ghosting of green on the beech trees. So we are nearly there. Good morning. I'm Mark Stephen, sitting here in the car park at Beechgrove in Aberdeen. Sitting about 40 miles to the north in his Bampshire garden, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, the plum tree is covered in blossom, and so is the... the apple's just coming. There's so much excitement. Anyway, tell us what you're doing. Get in touch. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295, and sadly, your standard network message rate applies. And you can call as well. Kenton's taking your calls this morning. 08085 9295 00, and just waiting on the sunshine.
Day before yesterday, I drove past a slow tree in full blossom.
Slow.
I can't tell you where it is, obviously, because... I need to kill you. It's been a glorious week of weather. I mean, a really gorgeous week of weather. What a difference a bit of sunshine makes. I've been in Kenmore catching up with the Lochtay Skiff Club and trying my hand at rowing their rather beautiful boat, and that'll be coming up later on.
Yeah, I've been hearing about golden-eyed duck in Aberdeenshire and adders, or rather the lack of them, at Muir of Dinnet Nature Reserve, and I saw a slow worm beside excitement.
Ooh. Very handsome little critters, those things. Yeah. Our swallows came back this week, but you've had even more interesting visitors.
Oh, yeah, have a wee listen to this. This is quite an interesting sound.
Is it a mole rubbing Vic in its vest?
Well, no, because it can't climb trees. Moles can't climb trees. The dogs were going nuts at the start of the week. I went out and I caught a wisp of a tail going up a tree, and I thought, gosh, is that a pine marten? Put a camera out, got a pine marten. Next night we got two pine martens. Ooh. Absolutely scoffing the peanuts. The downside is the squirrels, who the peanuts were for, have legged it, so they've disappeared. But yeah, I mean, two pine martens, absolutely gorgeous creatures. And I was speaking to the postman, Bill, and he said, yeah, there's a lot around here. So, if you've seen a pine marten, give us a shout. 08085 9295 00. And we do have a mystery bird. It's not a pine marten. Now, it's been a bit easy in the last couple of weeks, but we're a listener in Dallas, Texas, that's not Murray, has helped us out. Now, you may remember we read out his email last week where he said, I've sent you a recording taken from my garden in North Dallas recently, possibly a candidate for a mystery bird. So email me back if you can't work it out. I hadn't a clue, Graham, so I did. Anyway, here's his bird in Texas. Okay, now that's an American bird. It's not a British bird. It's not a thrush, which was my initial idea. But give Quentin a call if you think you know what that is, because it is an iconic bird in America. 08085 9295 00.
A couple of weeks ago, Ewan spoke to Stephen Corcoran about toads and what they're up to at this time of year, but amphibians aren't really Stephen's day job. He's in charge of an increasing number of folk involved in peatland restoration in the Cairngorms National Park, and he has got a massive budget to help him do it. But first, a very incisive question from Ewan, an unusually incisive question from Ewan. What is peat?
peat is basically partly decomposed vegetation, usually sphagnum, and so your peat forms in cool, wet conditions. You know, the vegetation doesn't quite rot down, and it forms layers of semi-decomposed vegetation, which then form peat. And that peat can form very slowly, like 1 millimetre a year at a time, but can be up to 13 metres deep in places.
Why should we care about peat?
Peatlands are a fantastic habitat full of biodiversity, full of carnivorous plants like, you know, sundews or sphagnum mosses, you know, dunlins and birds. So they're important just from the biodiversity. They're important from a carbon context because all that peat is storing millions of tons of carbon. And if the peatland's damaged, then it can release that carbon. So good quality peatland will store and then sequester carbon. But also peatlands help filter water. So an intact peatland, you'll have clean water coming out of it. They also slow the flow of water on it so that in very heavy rain events, the peatlands will slowly release the water. But if peatlands are damaged, then they fulfill none of those functions. They're bad for biodiversity. They increase flooding potentially. They release lots of carbon. And then they're adding sediment into the waterways.
Surprising we've got any at all. You know, gardeners, bad people when they were using peat. We burned it, we drained it, we planted trees on it. It's a miracle anything survived.
In the Kingaroos National Park, something like 25% of the park is on peatland, so it's a massive resource. It's one of our largest habitats in Scotland, and you know, we haven't maybe looked after it, you know, as best we should, because we maybe not understood how important it is. But now we really understand how important it is with a climate crisis and a biodiversity crisis, and is that actually these peatlands, you know, can provide a really good function to society if we repair them and look after them and bring us all those benefits in the fight for climate change.
You maybe disagree with me here, but when I first spoke to you many years ago, it wasn't very far up the political agenda, and that's changed. There's a real political commitment now to peat. People care.
And certainly in Scotland, that's been the work of Peatland Action that was established in 2013. And through Peatland Action and also the IUCN Peatland Programme, there's been a huge sort of drive to raise up the political agenda, showing how important peatlands are, what they can do for society, how we can fix them. And then, you know, with the whole global climate change crisis that's happening, that you can see that peatlands are one of those factors that can actually help in that fight. And so that's now, the Scottish Government's committed £250 million over the next 10 years for peatland restoration. So a huge amount of money. When I first started, there was just me as the peatland sort of person in the park. I've now got a team of six of us. We might be recruiting some more people. We've got a budget for the next 5 years of £23 million just in the park to deliver peatland restoration. So, yeah, it's huge. There's lots happening. You know, and it's, you know, happening all across Scotland.
Do you have the people? Do you have the expertise, the knowledge base out there from what must be a massive task?
Yeah, that is our biggest challenge. There's not enough experienced contractors that know how to do peatland restoration work. And also there's not enough experienced people like myself, you know, peatland ecologists, or, you know, if you look at the forestry sector, there's a whole industry that backs up forestry. We don't have that on peatland. We're building that. We're starting that process almost from scratch, of building up the expertise, building up the contractor base. So in the park here, one of the things we've done this last year, we've had a new entrance programme for peatland contractors to try and bring on usually local people, like a digger operator who might have a couple of guys who can drive diggers and machinery. And so we've taken on four new contractors. We've shown them how to do the basic peatland drain blocking techniques.
Now, these must be new jobs in parts of Scotland that really need good jobs.
Yeah, I think the contractors were all sort of doing work in sort of maybe upland environments, you know, but, you know, for them it's a new line of work, and they can see the value of investing in machinery, investing in staff, and that opportunity that's going to bring. So those four peatland contractors, they've all got additional work out of that because they're now a bit more experienced, and so we might be looking to put them onto slightly more challenging bits of work, and then bring in some new people maybe this year as well to develop that contractor base, because at the end of the day we're going to need more you know, people and machines, because that's what we need to do most of the work, is diggers.
Strange, isn't it? It's almost ironic that, you know, we spent, what, 40, 50, 60 years draining peatlands, digging
absolutely.
It up, etc., and now it's a massive amount of effort in an attempt to sort of re-wet it.
Yeah, it's such a massive job. What's the one that we were down in the central belt that they just chucked all the peat into the River Forth, and now it's just sitting in the estuary? All those black, sludgy mud things down at Grangemouth are the result of the excavation of the peat, which was 5 metres deep.
Yes, I think it may actually have been taller than that, truth to be told. I mean, they dug out an enormous amount of the stuff and just basically got rid of it. Again, they were trying to improve it. That's in the Carse of Stirling. So, you know, it's probably the biggest haymaking area in Scotland. And once upon a time, it would have been peatland.
Yeah. And a top tip, if you ever get the chance, sunny day, lie out on the moss and lie out on the peat and just, you know, star shape, look up to the sky and you can feel the moss beneath you just talking to you. It's a wonderful sensation.
Particularly if, as you did, you forgot to take your waterproofs.
Yeah. Absolutely soaked.
Never mind. One thing that we may well consider doing at some stage is the John O'Groats walking trail. It begins at Inverness and it follows the coastline for 147 miles up to John O'Groats. Now, it was really the brainchild of an American guy called Jay Wilson, who's a very keen walker, and I met him recently on the trail at Gorsby.
Pretty much every summer I go down to the Alps and do long-distance walking from hut to hut. And I basically live out of my backpack for 2, sometimes 3 weeks. And I've never really reached the limit. Some people, you know, they've had it after a certain amount of time. And I get the rhythm, the momentum of it, the simplicity of it. And I don't really miss the outside world.
You never been tempted to do something, you know, back home in the States, like the Appalachian Trail, the AT&T?
Well,
which is huge. It's over 2,000 miles.
I grew up about an hour's drive from the headquarters of the AT, the Appalachian Trail. And in fact, in the early days, before we got funding for our little octagonal markers, we used white blazes, just a white stripe painted on fence posts, as the marker for the John O'Groats Trail. And that was inspired by that being the official mark to this day of the Appalachian Trail.
Why are your markers hexagonal? Are they hexagonal or octagonal?
Octagonal.
Octagonal. I'm trying to visualize it.
There's a legend that the Jan de Groot, who started the first ferry at John O'Groats, and it was named after him, that he had 7 sons, and the 8 of them they built a house with 8 sides, and the legend has it, 8 doors. So that they could each enter this room and sit around an octagonal table so that, of course, it was sort of like the Knights of the Round Table. Nobody was at the head of the table was the idea. And that legend lives on. The current hotel there has an octagonal tower attached to it. Mm-hmm. And we thought, well, that's an appropriate symbol. So basically, we don't really have a symbol for the trail. The symbol is the marker itself. The 8-sided marker. When I'm out walking the trail, quite often I find a place that I just need to put up one more marker. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's more about me than it is about the trail, but sometimes you just want to put up another marker. So we'll put one up right here, and it's a northbound one. We usually put up a pair, but in this case I think there's sort of a need to make sure people understand which way the trail goes in the northbound direction. We try to direct them left, right, usually not up or down.
Yeah.
Usually straight ahead.
Yeah.
This is northbound. When we ordered the markers years ago, and this is the second or third batch that we're installing now, but when we first ordered the markers, I said, we don't need to say northbound or southbound. It's obvious enough on a coastal trail which way you're going. If you've lost track of whether the sea's on your right or your left, you probably shouldn't be walking anymore.
And yet,
one of the trustees was adamant that we should have two types of markers, northbound and southbound. And I said, well, you know, the people putting them up, and that's probably going to be me in a lot of cases, that's just going to be one more thing to mess up. I can't count the number of times that I've put up a northbound marker in the southbound direction and had and usually realized before I left the spot. But the truth is that it actually has helped in a lot of cases because it can be sort of ambiguous.
It's just something really relaxing about sitting in front of surf like this. You know, it's not big surf, it's just lapping the shore gently, but there's something soporific about it, to be honest. It almost makes me want to fall asleep.
Well, I have taken naps along the trail. It's a lovely coastline. I mean, you can barely see the other side because we're looking across the Murray Firth to the Murray coastline. Towns like Nairn and
Lossiemouth,
yes, Burghead. You don't have big waves. You've got a lapping coastline. You've got a variation of shingle beaches, sandy beaches, and some rocky shelf. We get seals that come up in both the spring and the autumn, both common and gray seals, along with the birds, the bird life, the occasional dolphin, and even the occasional pod of orca. And the wonderful thing about the trail, though you've got the A9 at your back if you ever need it, if you ever just had to get up to the highway, it's usually not far away. But because of the way the land lies, you usually don't hear it. Usually what you're hearing is the sea and the wind, which is nearly constant. Which, by the way, the wind keeps away the midges.
That's true.
So one of the nice things about the east coast of Scotland is that we really don't have the famous or infamous midges.
Jay Wilson on the John O'Groats Trail at Golspie, 147 miles. I reckon we could do it in 10 days.
Hey, well, even quicker than that. It's a lovely bit of coastline, you know, because we were up there at the Broch as well that they were reconstructing. I kind of take issue with them saying you don't get big waves. I've been absolutely terrified off the Smith Bank. Massive waves, hundreds of feet high. Terrified.
Usual slight exaggeration from Mr. McGriff.
He was talking about, you know, about his backpack, and he just keeps going. I was listening to Robin Knox Johnson talking about his round the world without stopping.
Yeah.
And as the closer he got back to England, he said, actually, I don't really want to stop this. Why do I need to go back? I'm having so much fun without meeting anybody. I'll just stay at sea.
Yes. Yeah, I can believe that, actually. It must be really quite difficult when you've done something of that nature that's occupied so much of your time and resources to stop.
This is apropos of nothing. 32-foot boat going around the world, took him 10 months, and it's all tins. You imagine how many tins you need to go around the world in 10 months.
Tin food. Wow. Anyway, if you'd like to hear more about the trail from Jay, you can have a listen to the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available now on BBC Sounds.
Time Travels is the Scottish history podcast for people who know that history is never just in the past.
All of a sudden, she's left without her husband. She has to bring up these children.
From the Edinburgh war widow who faced harsh realities in the 16th century.
There was a court case over one of her properties 2 or 3 weeks after Flodden.
Mommy's going out there, warrior queen in the courts.
To the plight of teenage brides in the 1970s.
It was a march to the altar, or more likely the registry office. Being a single mum was near unthinkable.
The whole point of a shotgun marriage was to hide. You are hiding something, you are keeping a secret.
Brand new Time Travels with Susan Morrison. Listen now on the BBC Sounds app.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Ewan McElriff. Coming up, we're going to be joined live by conservationist and TV presenter Megan McCubbin, who'll be telling us about a new BBC Bite Size Award, the Regenerators Hall of Fame. All will be explained. Plus, Ewan's on the lookout for slow worms on Deeside.
And this is quite depressing, the mystery bird. Somebody's got it right already, but have a listen. If you know what that is, then give Quentin a ring, 0808-592-9500. Satisfyingly, Colin and Mary Abercrombie in Dunblane got it wrong. They thought it was a a bald eagle, and Audrey and Colin and Fife thought it was a mockingbird. They were lucky enough to have a holiday house in Florida. Every morning were woken by the beautiful sound of the mockingbird, which it is, but this, it's not.
Stuart Robertson from Pollock thought it was a mockingbird too, as did Ross and Tainault, Susie from Spot, Tricia Hinton in Edinburgh. Alistair Leaven, however, thought, went, yay, mystery bird goes global. It's a blue jay. It reminds me of a great trip to Yosemite with my family 20 years ago. I love the how definite you were about that, Alistair, but sadly it's wrong. Gordon from Armadale thought it might be an American robin, and Kenny thought it might be a bluebird.
Yeah, I'm kind of loving this whole mystery bird international. Mm-hmm. It is the state bird of a couple of states in the States.
Okay, all right, fair enough. Okay. What's the name of that ground parrot in New Zealand again? That's a possibility. It's something like a kakapo.
You're on your own there, who knows?
Who would know? Who would know? We'll do something eventually. Get in touch if you think you know what it is. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or text 80295. The River Dee is well known around the world as one of the best rivers for salmon fishing in Scotland. A couple of weeks ago, I went to meet a couple of twins, Alistair and William Peak, with some originality that their company's called Twin Peaks Fly Fishing. Hence, they've inherited the love of fly fishing from their grandfather. Now, I met up with them at the place at Milton the Crathus, and Will led the way.
So we're just walking down from the shop down to the casting school. You can see that just here. And just to the right there is the new River Dee disinfection station, which we're about to open up to allow disinfection for anglers that are visiting the River Dee.
Okay.
So this is where we do all the casting lessons. But we don't only do casting lessons because we've got the tackle shop. It's very much a sort of try before you buy ethos. Yeah. So you make sure that rod and line and is exactly what it's going to do for what you're looking for.
How does your business model actually work? Because you're kind of tied into a local estate as well.
Yeah, so I suppose you could almost call it a slight partnership. But since we, first of all, took a very small part of the shop with Lady's Estate, I think that relationship has kind of grown, and then we were able to take a section of the river, which used to be part of their beat as well. So that enabled us to run the school. And then another place came available below, so we extended the shop. And then their fishing beat that they were running at the time, their gilly had retired, so there was an option to expand and take over the lease of the beat as well. So I think that since we've started working together, I think it's been very beneficial for both parties.
Yeah, basically, if somebody says, look, I want to learn to spay cast, for example, so that, you know, they turn up, you teach them, you can then quite literally book them in the next day onto a section of beat, and, you know, they're learning one day, they're doing it the next.
Exactly, yeah. So that's exactly what we do. And also, you know, we get some people that want to get into salmon fishing, so there's an learning the art and the craft of casting. But as a result of COVID, we had a huge increase in interest in fly fishing through local people, but also tourists visiting, wanting to spend a little bit more time outdoors on the river, but they don't know where to start. So generally, you know, we are based on the River Dee. We do a lot of guiding for Atlantic salmon, a lot of teaching spay casting. But quite often, it doesn't just start there. First of all, we say the tug is a drug. So it quite often begins with a quick casting lesson here at the school, and then going to a local fishery like Loch Inch or Raymoyer or Tulloch, and actually getting them to catch their first fish in that first window of their first sort of 2 to 3 hour window of experience in fly fishing. We want them to be getting a fish. And then once they've gone out and they've caught quite a few trout, and they might be buying an outfit from us so they can go off and do it on their own, then people progress to, okay, well, maybe I want to target wild trout on the river. So we do a lot on the rivers Don and Devron. And then they're like, okay, well, now I'm ready to focus on salmon. And salmon is, it's a drug, it's an addiction. You spend more time chasing the conditions and reading the weather forecasts and booking beats to try and intercept where you think the fish are going to be. But it's a lifestyle as well. And actually, you meet a huge amount of lovely people through the sport that you happily spend a whole day with on the river. Yeah, so it is social.
Right, talk me through the rod.
Right, so what we brought out is a 14-foot, 9-weight loop Evatec cast rod. Generally, as an all-rounder for the River Dee, a 14-foot in length, and the 9-weight is the line weight that matches it, is a great all-rounder for the Dee throughout the year. We could justify having 10 rods and loads of different applications for each. But actually, most people, a 14-foot 9 weight is the standard tool for the River Dee. We've got a reel on here, and we've got a floating line, actually with an intermediate tip. Okay, just a bit of wool on the end at the moment, because we'd actually fish this section of the river. It's just for casting.
Yeah, okay.
So spey casting, it was basically developed on the River Spey in the 1800s for being able to cast across a river when you've got no space behind you. So, you know, traditionally...
Trees right down to the bank.
Exactly. Yes. You know, traditionally, people would overhead cast, but what they found was that was limiting in where you could actually get a fly, because you needed as much space behind you as you do in front of you. So that's why spey casting was sort of created. Nowadays, we've got rods and lines that are designed to suit the spey casting style.
Okay.
The number one thing that we always try and introduce with people is safety. Okay, so the number one rule with fly fishing is always wear a pair of glasses, sunglasses, when you're fishing to protect your eyes. And the other one is use the correct cast for what the wind is doing. Okay, so notice now we have got a slight upstream breeze. There's not very much of it. But if the wind's coming upstream, then I need to cast with my D-loop on my upstream side, so the wind's blowing it away from me. And likewise, if the wind's going the other way, we have to cast with our left hand up, so the D-loop's downwind of us.
A D-loop.
D-loop, yeah. So right. We'll touch on that.
Right,
so
okay.
What I'm going to do is introduce to you the roll cast, which is the most basic form of spey casting. So every cast begins with the rod tip down at the water, hands about shoulder width apart with a loose, relaxed grip. Okay, it begins with a slow vertical lift, and then we drag that line backwards into what we call the key casting position, which is this position here. Can you see now we've got a loop of line from the rod tip to the water? That's what we call the D-loop.
The D-loop, yeah. Okay, because the water is kind of pulling it out that direction. Okay.
Yeah, and that's our casting weight. Okay. That's what we're going to pull the rod against. And then the line that's on the water, we call that the anchor, and that's going to hold the D-loop in place. Okay. So every spey cast has those two things, a D-loop and an anchor. Okay, and then for that forward cast, make your D-loop, push, pull, stop, and it will just travel out nicely. Okay, so we lift, we sweep it back, we create that nice D-loop, and then we flick it out. Yeah. Okay, some major faults that we see all the time here is just doing it really fast and too quickly.
Yeah.
It's not rawhide.
No, if you wish it out like that and you hear that whishing sound and it lands like spaghetti on the water, you're doing it too quick. So we always say less is more. And just do things nice and slowly, and then you'll get all the feeling out of that rod, and the rod does the work for you.
I'm trying it as we speak, and it's not looking pretty because my D-loop's getting tied up with the anchor. And the fact that I've got a bit of wool in, the wool's got tied up in the D-loop.
Yes.
And so we've got a figure of eight spaghetti.
Yes, it was when you asked me the other day, did you catch any fish? No, not with wool tied in the end, no. It wouldn't make any difference to be honest if they put a hook in the end, you know.
Well, you and I have been taught by some of the greatest experts in the world, and I've never been allowed a hook.
No, and for a very good reason too, very good reason. I mean, that was Will and Al Peak there. Stay tuned more from D-side, because I did actually take the rod over at one stage and give it a go. And it wasn't too bad. You know,
it's kind of like origami for angling, isn't it? You're kind of a big figure of eight. You're kind of arm wrestling to a certain extent. It's a strange thing, the spey cast.
Yeah, I actually find the process of casting, I find really quite relaxing. Actually, I don't know if it's the casting or just standing in the river. I don't know. I've spoken about this before. You know, I don't really have much of a hunting instinct. I was walking beside the A9 day before yesterday. The guy called Roger Morgan Grenville, and I crossed at one stage where I left him, he headed north, I came back down south, and I crossed this little bridge and I stopped and watched, and there must have been about a 3-foot salmon underneath just there. It was lovely to watch, you know, just moving about, you know, in the current. Right.
I'd probably be quite terrified, actually, if I did catch a salmon. I wouldn't know what to do with it.
Oh, just I'm sure you could come up with the right sauce. Coming up, why people are being asked to refrain from taking part in water sports in Loch Kinnord and Aberdeenshire, plus the identity of Ewan's international bird of mystery. That will be revealed.
Yeah, and somebody's got this right already, which is a bit of a disappointment, but it's not a British bird. Have a listen. Okay, there's a few folk got this right, but satisfyingly, Sandy Johnston alongside got it wrong. He says it was an oriole. Alexander, still in bed. In bed, and Molly.
Bed?
entering the spirit, though. Beep, beep. Is it the Roadrunner? Good try. And Craig Wilson said, now, it sounds a bit mad, but is it a woodpecker? It's known for the drilling sound, but also has a basic song. Well, I'm sure it does, Craig, but that's not it. Anyway, if you do know, 08 085 92 95 00. Quentin's taking your calls, and you can text 80295, and your standard network messagery applies.
Scott Matheson in a beautifully sunny Stirling says, morning, gentlemen. Love to hear your blossom reports. Is today's cheeky international mystery bird the iconic northern mockingbird? No, Scott, it's not. Helen Mack also thought it was a mockingbird. Daniel thought it was a white-tailed eagle. Says, thank you for the great work. He's recovering from a broken wrist, and the show is one of the few things keeping him sane. He must be living right on the edge, he must. Alistair and Elgin says, good morning, gentlemen. The American contribution was named by a homesick Scot from Forres. It's a Dallas Dew.
Oh.
With apologies. And John and Lewis and Ruthie Norman thought it might be a bluebird. If not, it has to be a thunderbird. Going, of course. Interesting programme already. Thank you, especially about Pete and how attitudes have changed. Yeah, good point. This is quite nice, too. It says, I usually listen to the podcast. This is anonymous. I don't know why it's anonymous, because it's a nice comment. It says, I usually listen to the podcast recording of the show, but today I'm listening live from the beautiful Isle of Ulva while looking across to Benmore from outside the Boathouse Cafe, which my friends run, and getting ready for the second day of a massive three-day beach clean here on the island. We've already removed bags and bags of marine litter off the island by boat yesterday, and a team of amazing volunteers will be working hard to remove even more over the weekend. Your show is the perfect start to the day. Oh, thank you very much for that.
Good luck with your beach clean. It's great. Just wonder why he wants to be anonymous. What's going on there?
Beats me. Just modesty. And Ian McDade says, we heard our first cuckoo on Tuesday this week here in Carron Valley. Swallows have been here for 10 days, all happening here. Quite a privilege to witness. The busyness of spring is like a symphony from Mother Nature. There you go. See, that's a class comment right there. Yeah, yeah. No bother. Last summer, you may remember, we started to follow the journey of the River Tees. Was it last summer or the summer before?
I don't know. It all blends into one.
I'm sure it was the summer before, but never mind. We spent a bit of time around Loch Tay and met up with members of the recently formed Loch Tay Skiff Club. Not Skiffle Club, that's a different thing altogether. At this point, the skiff, named Nian Rua, red-haired daughter, had not been launched.
Yeah, and due to COVID, it was still under lock and key in a boat shed, but we were able to gaze lovingly on the black and red and white paintwork. I mean, it looked a bit like a miniature Waverley. It was a beautiful thing.
It still is a beautiful thing. This week I was back in the area, so I decided to catch up with club members Adam Harrison and Linda Cracknell to find out just what progress they'd made, how they were getting on actually rowing the thing.
OK, hold oars up. Right, if you can have... Starboard oars forward rowing, port oars back rowing, please. Okay, good, ready? Ready to row and row.
When I've done my work of day, and I row my boat away, doon the waters all of Tay.
This is just lovely. I feel like Pharaoh being rowed up the Nile. What was it like the first time you got this thing on the water?
It was very exciting. It was a lovely, lovely warm summer's day, and it was just so remarkable to see it floating after 2 years.
How was the job actually done? Because when we saw inside the boat shed, there wasn't a lot of room in there.
Well, we had the boat came out that it was an evening, wasn't it? And we rolled her out and then had to do a swing round and then just sort of edged towards the water once everything had been fitted. And gradually, you know, you've just seen the process of going off the launching trailer. And it's quite shallow over there, so it took a little while. And it was Charlotte who suddenly realised that the trailer had slipped out from underneath and she was floating. And it was a sort of an amazing moment. And then once afloat, to move her to the other side of the jetty was just so easy because, you know, she's just incredibly responsive. Uh-huh. And then we just sort of went, oh, maybe we should actually get in. So Angus got in first, having been the leader of the building, and the rest of us got in and off we went into the middle of the loch. Yeah.
How long did they get the hang of rowing?
I still don't think I have, actually. I think, you know, just being able to move it and enjoy it is really simple, but actually getting good enough for racing and, you know, following the admirable commands of our leader has always been a problem. But, yeah, just getting enough to enjoy it is really simple.
How long was it before you actually tried a race?
Well, we went to our first regatta about 3 weeks ago, I think. It was 3 weeks ago at Loch Hall Meadows. And the first time we'd been, any, you know, taken her anywhere off the loch, so it was with some trepidation. But we had an absolutely marvellous day. There were six other clubs there from around five, incredibly welcoming, you know, making it very plain that this was intended to be fun. I think there were six races altogether. I mean, I think we felt, although we did come in seventh in every one, we felt that we did quite well, really, because we got round. There were sort of a couple of small incidents, but, you know, we did it, and it was just a lot of fun.
And what does it do, I mean, a project like this, what does it do for the community?
I think what we've found lovely is that inevitably when you're doing something of this nature on the water, it's changed our perspective on the area in that you're thinking of Loch Tay as being at the centre of a geography. So we could be, you know, there could be people from all the way along the loch coming to go on the boat. And I think the other thing is that it's quite a cross-section of people. I mean, I would say we haven't got that many young people yet, but we've got an event coming up on this Saturday where people can come for a tryout. So hopefully there'll be some people who might come along, want to have a go, see whether it appeals to them. And you usually find that once somebody's been in the boat and realise that, as Adam says, you can actually move relatively easily by rowing, most people get the bug.
And what's really nice also in a rowing boat is that, you know, you can stop and it's silent and you can just appreciate this amazing landscape around you and the sounds and the wildlife. And even if you're sailing, you're always busy trying to control the boat. With this thing, you can just pause, and that's a real luxury, I think.
I quite fancy a go at rowing. Can I give it a go?
Yeah, absolutely.
OK, we're gonna give it a go with me rowing.
OK, so how are you in your rowing,
Mark? Pretty awful, but carry on.
You joined the club, then?
Yeah, that's it.
So what we'll do is, we'll just give a quick run over, we'll do ready to row, and if we can get in position, and you're basically following Charlotte's oar, following the rhythm of the stroke oar, the red one, really.
Right,
so
OK.
You can try and keep in time with that, then we're ready. So when we get ready, so if you get your row into position, so lean forward, so everyone leaning forward, that's it, ready to row, and then ready to row, and row.
You know your lovely hair has more glamour only declare than all the dresses wear. Twigs killing another penny.
I've done this before, and the problem with this and radio is it's almost impossible to do something that requires a degree of concentration and speak at the same time successfully. I'm just mesmerised by Charlotte's red oar.
And what we'll do is we'll get Charlotte's red oar to go a bit faster now, really.
Oh, good idea. Lovely way to get exercise in the fresh air, and you know, there's a real sense of satisfaction at that.
Yes, exercise, fresh air, and camaraderie, really. You know, it's a lovely, lovely way to work with people, and it's probably one of the few active things that I do that actually require to be with a number of people, which is lovely. So, you know, we've had fantastic support, we've had a great cox who came over from St Andrews and gave us a whole weekend of her time in February, I think it was. And we were all out on the water getting, you know, skills training and rowing and a bit of coxing. And then just about a month ago, we had a whole weekend of cox training through the Scottish Coastal Rowing Association. So there's 11 of us now who, in theory, are trained to cox. And we learnt a lot, including you know, how to get somebody out of the water unless they don't capsize. But if you did need to get somebody out of the water for any reason, we know how to do it now.
Well, they're going a bit faster than us. Speedboat
coming
down.
They're not having as much fun, though.
They're not having as much fun, absolutely not. Right. Right then, Captain Bligh.
Ready to row. And row.
So the folk on the left-hand side of the boat are still rowing, so we're turning round, heading back towards the beach. Any second now, the folk on the right-hand side of the boat will pick up too, and there we go. There's a bit more cloud to the west, which is forming really interesting shadow patterns on the slopes of Ben Lawers. And when the boat was stopped there, I could clearly hear blackbirds singing in the trees about 100 metres away. This is a lovely way to travel. Out in the Nian Rua with some members from the Lochte Skiff Club, Linda and Adam and Angus and Charlotte. I think the other lady was called Melanie, but I could be wrong, and if I got your name wrong, I really apologise. It was a beautiful afternoon. Lovely.
Yeah, I just love the way that you can concentrate and speak at the same time. And
out of the
such
question.
A skill.
Out absolutely. Of the question. It was just... No, forget it. Just tell you what would have confused you. You know, as you're sitting in the boat rowing, port uh-huh. is on your right.
Okay, yeah.
Yep.
It's just amazing how it's taken off, because, yeah. I don't know, was it 10 years ago, 12 years ago, mm-hmm. started down in Fife, and it has just exploded around the whole coastline of Britain. It's such a wonderful thing.
I think there's over 200 of them now. Well, knocking on for 200, one of the two. But Carol, from a very grey chaplaincy in Orkney, says, Kia ora, Mark and Ewan.
Kia ora to you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm liking the International Mystery Bird. Great idea and an even greater challenge on a Saturday morning. And she got the correct answer, which I'm not giving out just now. But she goes on to say, you are right. The kakapo is the New Zealand parrot. Great to hear a New Zealand bird mentioned, a lovely reminder of home and trips into the mountain regions, with the added joy of returning to the car park to find that your window and windscreen wiper seals were still in one piece.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you've got a recording of a mystery bird throughout the world and you're confident what it is, get in touch, email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, because we're going to have to take your word for it.
Yeah, I was about to say, why are you holding people to higher standards than we ourselves apply?
I am
confident that you know what it is. Well, educated guesses, that's what we specialise at.
2 years we've been getting away with it.
Yeah, well, that's true. Having fun in Lochte earlier this week, we also heard that Nature Scott was appealing to the public not to take water sports over the summer on Loch Kinnord. Now, Loch Kinnord is part of their Muir of Dinant Nature Reserve in Aberdeenshire.
Yeah, and we thought, this is pretty drastic action. So I went along to find out what was behind the move, and I met up with Reserve Manager Kirsten Mayer, and she sets the scene.
We are standing on the north shore of the beautiful Loch Kinnord. Loch Kinnord is a 80-hectare loch, and as you can see to the east and to the west, it's fringed with these lovely fen and reed beds. It's quite a highly indented loch, so you can see in front of us we've got several islands. This little one off to our right is Crannock, the remains of an ancient Crannock. To the right of that is our slightly larger one called Castle Island, which is where the cormorants and greylags are really concentrated at the moment.
This is an important nature reserve.
Absolutely. So we're highly designated for the wildlife that we find here. We are a SSSI, Site of Special Scientific Interest, and that's actually larger than the reserve boundaries. But our lochs themselves fall under special areas of conservation, and that is for their clear water quality, for their fringing reed bed vegetation, and for our non-breeding bird assemblages, and we are a stronghold for otter as well.
And you've got Goldeneye.
I have Goldeneye.
Fantastic wee ducks.
They're superb. They're very flamboyant in their courtship and mating rituals. And they're also incredibly rare breeders in Scotland and the UK. So we think at the height of their success in Chesapeake and Deeside, there might have been 200 breeding pairs, but we believe that has actually dropped down to 100 breeding pairs.
So this is a really important site for Goldeneye.
It's almost like the crucible of their success in Deeside. So they're quite latecomers to the area. The first Goldeneye was recorded in 1997. At the height of their success here in 2009, Loch Kinnard and Loch Davin, both our loch complexes, produced over 54 Goldeneye.
Wow. Chicks. So that's the positive side. There is a downside to this conversation we're going to have, because, you know, we're on the banks of the loch, fringed by trees. It is a gorgeous place, and you've got a lovely stretch of water, which has got to be a magnet for people.
It is, absolutely. Pre-COVID lockdown, we were actually quite sustainably used by locals and water access users. In 2019, I don't recall water access being an issue at all. And then we were released from lockdown, and we suddenly... the surge in use, and it wasn't just water use, it was camping and kind of festival like kind of style. We had a lot of campfires. I mean, we kind of horrifically had 72 new fire pits created around the shoreline.
So you've got a massive fire risk, you've got a nationally important breeding duck, and you've got people who presumably have the right to go in the water.
Of course they do, and I would just like to say I love connecting people with place, and I love seeing people enjoying the reserve responsibly, as does Nature Scott. I mean, in Scotland, we have some of the best access rights in the world, but...
Is that red kite? Sorry.
Yes, we do.
Just off to the left there on the trees.
You can quite often hear them pewing as well. We've got a nest.
Sorry, I interrupted you there. You've got a lot of people coming in here, and frankly, you would rather they didn't get out in the water.
First, but you know, a certain period of the year. So we took ornithological advice. Some of the species that we find breeding here are early breeders. Things like our grebe are early breeders. Mallard and grey-legged geese can also breed very early. We want to give our birds the best chance that they have to go through their quite elaborate courtship rituals as well. I watched the Goldeneye from February onwards chasing females and males, you know, and they started as one big congregation, but then they've slowly disentangled into small little groups of maybe one male to two females.
But if you come down with a canoe, put it out there, is that really going to disturb the breeding?
A single canoe, absolutely not. And I know a lot of people here do take water access incredibly responsibly, and are very open to us telling them, please don't approach the islands, we've got breeding birds there, stay away from the reed beds in the west and the east. However, it's a case of cumulative impact. And we were finding last year, when we initially asked for people to think about going elsewhere and taking water access, if they found three or more craft on the water, was not working. It simply wasn't working.
So you're going up and talking to them, you don't have any powers to stop them. What kind of response are you getting once people are made aware of the issue?
Incredibly positive, absolutely positive. I think last year was a bit of an eye-opener. I talked to a lot of stand-up paddleboarders, and they all said, yes, we are aware, looking out over the loch, if other people were already there, that this might not be the place to come in the future. So I think we had a lot of single users, and then very open and saying, actually, this might not be the place to come back to.
You're also wanting to cover this voluntary ban till the back end of August. I mean, surely once spring's over, you're clear.
Well, we have got a breeding bird assemblage. So our birds are breeding and raising chicks at intervals throughout the breeding season. We're not even particularly talking about birds that might second brood like our mallard, but we are talking about birds that might fail initially. The vagaries of Scottish weather in May, quite often that is accompanied by a lot of rain and chilling of eggs and chicks, and it's allowing these strong pair bonded birds to retry, really. That is what we're asking.
So they are breeding till the end of August?
They are. And the other thing, the history of Goldeneye here is really interesting. In 2007, every Goldeneye that bred on Deeside was later recorded on Loch Kinnard. And what they're doing is they're coming here for our shallow, very clear, invertebrate-rich waters. The chicks are too buoyant to dive deeply. So shallow water is quite an important parameter for them, yeah.
You're calling for a voluntary ban. As I said, you've got no powers. But does this suggest that maybe bylaws are on the horizon, or are you actively avoiding that?
So this year is the first year that we're gathering together a really strong data set. I survey and count this loch twice a week, and we're managing to get this request for people not to take water access right from the beginning of the breeding season. This is under review. We will keep a close eye on actually what occurs here this year, and see where that takes us.
Kirsten Mayer, Reserve Manager for Muir of Dinant National Nature Reserve. We'll hear more from her later in the programme when she and Ewan go for a hunt for adders. I love that idea about the golden-eyed chicks being too buoyant to dive deep.
Yeah, yeah, nope. Bouncing up in shallow water. But yeah, it's an interesting, serious issue. 70 fire pits. And Kirsten was telling me that actually Scottish Fire and Rescue are going to be going out and patrol with them to speak to people about the fire risk. There was fire warnings this morning on the news that this time of year Scotland is tinder dry. Mm-hmm. And you've got a lot of people. And as she said, it's kind of festival-type atmosphere. It's people partying big time by the loch, fires all over the place. And a very valuable resource for Goldeneye, which are lovely ducks. And yeah, you can see the point. You don't want bylaws throughout Scotland, but you do have to protect our wildlife.
Yeah, no, I must give out, when we discussed it for a start, our reaction
was... Yeah, we got angry.
Our reaction was identical, which was, really? You know, absolutely nothing for this period, you know, which would be the big period of summer, you know, which when people actually want to go and do these things. But having heard the argument, you can see the point.
Yeah, and there's lots of other places to go as well. And I think, as Kirsten was saying, once you go up to people and explain what the situation is, they get it. Mm-hmm. But the trouble is, you're driving down the road from Ballot or whatever, and you see 10, 20 people out in the loch, they'll all give that a go. And mm-hmm. it's a beautiful place, and you can see why they want to do it. But mm-hmm. you just have to accept a bit of kind of collective responsibility, I suppose, that some places need to be left alone to the wildlife. Mm.
Yeah, I said, well, it is, you know, we have the right of responsible access, you know, and the key, obviously, word that it is responsible. Let's go back now to my fishing line with the Twin Peaks, Alan Will. Before the news, Will was very kindly giving me hints and tips to avoid the line landing, as he put it, like spaghetti on the water. But had his advice and tuition made any difference?
The sound of a good cast should be a swish, not a swoosh. Nice high pitch. And the sound of a bad cast is trying a bit too hard and giving you a much lower pitch.
As you say, it kind of falls into the water of spaghetti.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so less is more, and get the rod doing the work for you.
Can I try it?
Yeah. So hands about shoulder width apart. I'd just go right hand uppermost.
Right hand uppermost.
That's it. Okay, right. And just start with the rod tip down at the water.
Okay.
And then do a slow vertical lift to about 45 degrees. Now drag it back nice and slow until you get that big D loop behind you.
Okay.
That's it. And then push, pull, stop. Pretty good first attempt. I think we might have a natural. So do us another one.
Okay.
So slow vertical lift.
45.
Yeah, dragging back.
Spaghetti. Beginner's luck the first time round.
So
right.
If you move that bottom hand further down the core, dragging back nice and slow, watch that D-loop form, and pull in with your bottom hand.
Got it. So effectively you're pivoting around a central point.
Exactly.
Okay, right, fine, okay.
The best casters in the world have the best stops, okay? So as you drive that rod forward in that forward cast, mm-hmm. once that rod gets to 45 degrees in front of you at the tops of the trees,
stop
the rod dead, and that'll put all the energy from that bent rod into the fly line.
Okay.
There we go. See the difference?
Yeah.
The hardest part of fly fishing is the first 2 hours. Yeah. You know, it's learning the basics of the casting and getting frustrated with it and it not quite going well. And then you find yourself fishing on your own somewhere and you can't remember how to fix that fault that's happening. And so that's why we set up the school, because we got a passion for instructing and teaching and helping people to become better at it. And it's very rewarding. You know, some people we've taught them the first cast. We've been with them when they've caught the first fish, and we've then been with them when they've caught the first 30-pound fish down in Patagonia. You know, so we like to think that, you know, through that journey of fly fishing, you know, it's the long game. We're not just there for a quick sale of a rod or a casting lesson. It's actually, let's keep a good relationship throughout that fishing career, because we're interested in where people fish and what they enjoy about it, and also maybe give them the opportunity to try new things or fish in new places.
It's lovely just watching the way that it kind of kisses down onto the water. It's a very gentle thing there.
Because we want good presentation. The art of fly fishing is we're going to present a small fly, sometimes larger ones, and the fly doesn't have any weight. So unlike spin fishing where you have like a metal lure or you've got weight in the lure, the fly is generally quite weightless. So we use the weight of the line to get it out. And so as that loop unrolls, you can see it creates a loop shape in the air.
Yeah.
And then as it travels out into the river, it then slows down. And so we're able to present lightweight flies at distance, but still get it to land gently.
When you're fishing properly yourself and you're not being annoyed by broadcasters, you would be able to see a fish or know that a fish was in a particular position in a pool and drop that fly just in front of it?
That's the magic of it, and that's the idea. The magical thing on the day is most of the beats have gillies on the river as well, and those gillies will know their beat intimately. So what you're doing is you're looking at the river, the height of the river, the speed of the water, and the depth, and the time of year, and the temperature of the water. So, for instance, on Crathis Castle at the moment, the water's getting a little bit lower. The water's going to be quite cold at the moment. We're going to be looking for the fish in certain spots. And catch records going back many years will tell you historically where fish are caught during certain heights and different months. So, yeah, and that's part of the magic. You start to read the water. You start to try and think a little bit like a fish. You can't see them, but you imagine where would I be in these conditions, in this height of water today. It's quite funny, you know, the anglers are not just fly fishermen, but all anglers. They're an optimistic bunch because we can't see what we're fishing for. You know, we fish with an element of faith that we're going to get lucky. And the more you do it and the more you understand it, the slightly more lucky you become.
Yeah, we have a similar expression. The more we practice, the luckier we get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the fish have to be there, you know, and because we're pursuing a wild quarry, sometimes the fish are running through, sometimes you don't get them, you know, but you can be humbled with finishing that day's fishing, knowing that you covered the water to the best of your ability and you saw some wonderful wildlife. And there's something about moving water as a sort of a zen-like sort of just relaxation and sort of reset. And we get a lot of people that are sort of in high-powered jobs, lots of stress in their life, and their fix is they go fishing. Some people run, cycle, meditate, some fish.
Will and Al Peak there. And if you fancy giving fishing a go, there's a link to the Twin Peaks website from ours.
Did you catch a fish as you caressed the waves with your fly?
How many times have I got to tell you? There was just a bit of wool in the end. There is no way of catching a fish. No.
You didn't progress to a hook?
No, of course not.
Well, what's the point? Surely.
Now that's a question that's way above my pay grade. No, I mean, I just enjoy standing beside the river. I enjoy standing beside the river, you know, and on the few occasions where I was able to actually do it in a way that the line kind of gentled onto the water, I love watching that. That's very satisfying for me. Tell you who I was talking to the other day that you will remember, Ali Gowans. Remember we used to sort of meet up at Kenmore every year?
Ali taught me with a bit of wool on the end of the line as well.
Surprised he even let you use the wool. But, you know, no, I went round to see Ali and Moira, because I haven't seen them in a couple of years, because we used to do every year, Ali and I, the opening of the salmon fishing season on the Tay at Kenmore. And it was kind of like a sort of comedy act that somebody put it, it wasn't little and large, it was large and large. But, you know, he's still fishing, he's still, you know, he still loves getting out in various locations and things and just putting the line out in the water. So it's a lifetime thing.
Yeah, I remember vividly when I was about 7 years old going down to the Esk with my grandfather, split cane rod, teaching me how to cast, and I broke it and he never took me fishing again.
Oh, no, that's very sad. Anyway, you're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElroy. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to it. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Steve Muir did. He said, "Dear gentlemen, thank you for your excellent programme, which we are enjoying live from Loch Shieldegg, Brisbane, Australia, being the usual venue.
We love Scotland and have visited before, but this holiday is particularly special. My partner Sarah has been lugging her backpack as well as our first child due in September. Oh, congratulations. We mightn't have had the Scottish spring you heralded, but it suited us fine. Wednesday this week, we had a majestic Sylvan all to ourselves, and the weather held off until we made the ridge.
He goes on to say, the walk back to the car park was cold and wet, but so worth it. We were just as lucky at Stack Polly on Thursday, and yesterday we walked the Applecross Peninsula with sunny views across the sky. Sarah will celebrate her birthday on this trip, and we would love it if you sang for her. Happy birthday to you.
Happy birthday,
dear Sarah.
Happy birthday to you. Yeah, no, fine. Sadly, we got this email a couple of weeks ago, so we've maybe missed Sarah's birthday. We tried, Sarah. Happy birthday anyway. Sounds like an amazing trip, and best of luck with the wee one when it comes.
I'm Michelle McManus, and a warm welcome to 100 Years of Scottish Stories.
We're sharing your family stories to mark the centenary of the BBC.
My father had a lot to do with the discovery of Andy Stewart.
The boot lid of the vehicle had blown open to allow a pig to jump on the roadway.
In a special compilation, we hear the tales that just have to be passed down to the next generation.
Mum and Dad's adventures on the tandem, they cycled back in the moonlight.
He painted and drew with his feet.
100 years of Scottish stories from BBC Radio Scotland. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Actually, what I would like to hear is the stories that your family must never find out about. That would be an interesting programme.
Yeah, moving on.
You're listening to Outdoors. We've told you that before. Anyway, on BBC Radio Scotland, I'm Mark Stevens, Ewan McElwraith. Next week is International Dawn Chorus Day. And once again, Ewan, he's going to be out bright and early and live on the radio on Sunday morning. Ahead of that, Radio Scotland's Travelling Folk has actually got a bird special this coming Thursday. Presented by Julie Fowlis and featuring music from Phil Cunningham and Team Edie, it's sure to be an excellent warm-up to the Dawn Chorus celebrations at the weekend, so tune into that on Thursday and, of course, catch up afterwards on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, we're looking forward to listening out for the Dawn Chorus at the Inchgarth Reservoir next weekend. And speaking of birds, the international mystery bird. Guesses coming thick and fast, satisfyingly. Many people getting it wrong, but have a listen to this. Yeah, so get in touch, email outofdoors at bbc.co.uk. Quite a few people getting in touch already. I was going to give you a clue. Mm-hmm. I was thinking Vatican.
Too obvious. Bernie O'Connor thought it might be a mockingbird. Nige from Balerno thought it was a blue jay. Gordon Brown thought it might be a roadrunner. And Alan from Edinburgh thought it might be a buzzard. Liz and Ullipole thought it was a roadrunner too. Yeah, anyway. Have you or someone you know done something incredible for the planet this year? Yesterday on Earth Day, BBC Bite Size launched the Regenerators Hall of Fame, a celebration of young climate champions from across the UK who are passionate about the planet and taking action to protect it. We're delighted to be joined now by one of the judges, zoologist and broadcaster Megan McCubbin. Good morning, Megan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Not bad at all. Just explain this concept behind me, the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, well, there's so many incredible young people out there who are going above and beyond to protect biodiversity, the planet, you know, the areas in which they live. So it's really about giving them a little bit of recognition and trying to inspire others to join them and take part in these actions as well. So it's essentially, you know, a hall of fame. You can nominate someone you know between the ages of 5 and 16. You can put yourself in the mix. It could be a school, a community, a youth group, someone who you think's done something really special. And then it will go through a judging process, and yeah, I can't wait to see all the nominees.
Yeah, what kind of things are you looking for the young people to have actually done? Have you got a couple of examples?
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything. You know, you could have stopped being plastic being used in your, you know, your sports team, or you could have taken part in a rewilding project, or, you know, helped your community with litter picking. It could be, you know, for me personally as a judge, what I'm looking for is passion and, you know, someone who's really excited about what they're doing and kind of getting others involved. So, you know, we're looking for a bit of creativity, you know, whatever they think is important to them, and how they bring others involved and use their voice to kind of inspire, and whether that's reducing waste, nature at home, you know, changing your lifestyle, getting your parents involved, you know, to use the bus more and less of the car, whatever is meaningful to them. So that's what's the exciting thing about it.
But you've got primary schools taking part, you've got secondary schools taking part, you've got community groups. How are you going to judge that? I mean, there's such a diverse mix of people doing great things.
Yeah, I think it's going to be difficult, in all honesty, because I'm expecting there's going to be some amazing people and some incredible stories coming in. So, yeah, we've got three individual awards. So that goes for between 5 and 9 year olds. And then we've got an award between 10 and 13 and then 14 to 16. And then the group awards are, as you say, primary, secondary and community. And I think it is going to be really, really tough. So, yeah, I think it will take us a little while and probably a few conversations.
Is there a peak age for young people to get really passionate about the environment and do some of them just grow out of it?
To be honest, I think there's never a peak age. I think, you know, young people often, you know, you're born with this innate curiosity of the life around you. You know, we see kids all the time at a really young age. I mean, I remember being 3-4 years old chasing butterflies around the garden. And it's just this fascination. It's whether it's the movement, the colour, it's this kind of raw and organic curiosity that we're all kind of born with, I suppose. And I think young people are more active in the environmental sector now, more so than ever, than any, you know, young generation has been, because it's their future that they're needing to protect. And we're seeing, you know, a climate crisis, a biodiversity crisis, which is very concerning and only increasing in severity. So, you know, young people are taking their futures into their own hands and becoming very active and vocal and knowledgeable. And it's, you know, really important that we listen to those voices. And I think sometimes we do lose that bit of curiosity as we get up and get older, and we kind of get distracted by everyday adult things. So I always say, you know, it's really important to harness that inner childlike curiosity, because, you know, following a butterfly around, I mean, I'm 27 years old and I still get so much joy out of that. You know, whatever it means to you, whatever gets you excited, it's just taking 5 minutes to go outside, you know, put your phone away, sit down and connect with nature. And actually you'll find it really grounding, have some really kind of, you know, mental health benefits. You're going to feel, you know, feel really positive afterwards, and you connect with what's on your doorstep and what's more important than that. And young people do it brilliantly. So that's what Regenerators Hall of Fame is all about.
Are you finding young folk are getting angry about the environment? We were seeing a marine biologist, Claire Matthews, the other week up at Macduff Aquarium, and she said, we need to harness that anger. People are really passionate about it. And yeah, they should be standing up and shouting, this is our future, just stop it.
Yeah, I think so. I think people are frustrated, you know, because we've been talking about the climate and biodiversity crisis for a long time now. And, you know, ultimately it should have been something that we started acting on yesterday and not tomorrow. And, you know, we're always given these promises and pledges and, you know, a lot of us are fed up of the talking, and, you know, we're really excited by the action, and we need things to happen very, very quickly if we're to start reducing temperatures and protect biodiversity. So I think there is frustration, but whilst there's frustration, I think there's also a lot of hope and a lot of fantastic things happening, and actions are starting to come through, you know, and these young people were a perfect example of that. So it's shining a light on them, hoping to inspire others to take on the baton and, you know, and get involved as well.
So if family members or friends or teachers potentially, you know, want to nominate somebody for this Regenerator Hall of Fame, how do you go about doing it?
So you can go onto the BBC Bite Size website, and all you have to do is submit a 250 words outlining exactly why they're your climate champion and why you think, you know, they deserve this recognition. A little bit about how they did it and the impact that it has had, you know, how far has their actions reached, who's been inspired by it, and then a couple bits of supporting information, videos or news articles, photos, whatever it may be, whatever you may have. And it's really as simple as that. So it's quite a quick process. And then, yeah, we'll be handed over to the judges, which probably won't be a quick process.
Might take a wee while. Megan, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Not at all. Thank you very much.
Megan McCubbin there. If you want to find out more about the Regenerators Hall of Fame, as Megan said there, you can head, well, you can head to our website and you'll find a link to all their details and sort of hunt it down from there. Now, adders are the only native venomous snakes in Scotland, and they are a bit on the elusive side on the whole.
Yeah, I've gone my whole career without seeing one until a couple of years back in Immune of Dinnet. It's the only place I've ever seen one. So I was back up there earlier with Kirsten, and we went for a wee walk to see if we could double my adder count.
Our adder emerged in late February, 22nd of February was the first small male that I saw, and then he slipped away as it started snowing again. But we've been experiencing some really exceptionally warm weather across this month, and actually mid-March was beautifully sunny and hot as well.
You refer to this as the golden month.
The males emerge first, followed by the females a couple of weeks later. They go through quite a sedentary period where the males are getting ready to shed, and they look quite dull during that period, kind of dull-eyed. The colours aren't particularly vibrant, but we've actually been picking up shed skins pretty frequently across this last week, and then that will be followed by the famous adder dance.
Well, talk me through that, because I've never seen it, and probably not a hope in hell I've seen it today, but it's a thing of glory.
It absolutely is. It's a very almost kind of seductive dance between two males where they entwine themselves around each other and kind of chase across the grass. I have to say, I've not seen it personally, but a lot of very nice visitors have sent in footage. They've seen it.
There's nothing seductive about it, though. It's arm wrestling for adults.
It absolutely is. It's a dominant aggression tactic. They want to be the first to claim the females. And interestingly, female adders are promiscuous.
Never.
And that is quite unusual. It really is. Well, it makes evolutionary sense for a male to be promiscuous. You know, we want to mate with as many females as possible. She chooses quite selectively the males that she wants to mate with. And she's definitely going for the strongest, the biggest.
Okay, where are we looking?
Okay, so we are about 11 o'clock in the morning. It's a fairly warm day. There's absolutely no guarantees. Adders respond to vibration, to shadows. They can see us and they can taste us as well. So the thing is to go slowly and slowly walk our way down this wall line.
And not say anything.
And not say anything until we see one.
Okay, right, well, here you go. I'll keep quiet.
And apparently, what makes this such a great site for adder is that we have an abundance of south-facing bracken-filled slopes. And this is really important for hibernating snakes. They use the bracken basically as kind of insulation against icy weather. And we've actually been selected as a survey site for a national survey of the status of adder across Scotland. And it's a repeat of a survey that was undertaken 30 years ago. So adder will typically bask out in the open for the first couple of hours in the morning. And then they'll slide away into cover to hunt. And I don't know, you can see that this bracken, broken strands of bracken, are forming kind of little tent-like structures. And for an ambush predator, they navigate their way through these little avenues that are open in the bracken. So if you do walk into the bracken, you quite often almost trip over them.
Right, we've been prowling about in the bracken for quite a while now. With no joy, but such is the experience of wildlife watching, but potentially too hot for them.
It actually is. We're quite far on in the morning. Adders will bask to raise themselves up to an ambient temperature where they're then energised to hunt. So I think that's very probably what they're occupied with at the moment. They've bigger things to do than sunbathe for us at the moment. But late afternoon is a period when you should come back out as the temperature kind of slowly drops, and they should be back out and basking.
Can't win them all. Well, we failed on the adder front, but we've come back to the visitor centre. And you're hopefully going to show me something else. What are we hoping to see?
So we are hoping to see a slow worm that has recently detached its own tail. They do this as a last defence strategy against birds that are trying to peck and eat them.
Okay, what is a slow worm?
So a slow worm, often known as a legless lizard, but that conjures up some slight drunkenness.
Okay, but it's not a worm.
It's not a worm.
I've seen one in my life and it was a beautiful copper-coloured thing.
You do get them in the copper colour. This fellow is a bit more of a clay grey. So these are what is known as refugia or tins, and they're used by reptile surveyors.
Just looks like a wee bit of asphalt.
It's a bit of roofing felt. It is a bit of roofing felt. They soak up the rays of the sun. This one is toasty hot at the moment. So there are great areas as the sun is just rising and the lizards are trying to get up to warmth.
Well, let's go and see if we get one. Oh! You've redeemed yourself.
Right.
Well, so you described that as kind of clay colour, but it's like a deep deep bronze, goldy bronze.
The glinting, there's definitely a glinting quality to them. This lizard in particular has been here for the last 3 days. He's not moving particularly. He is alive, he's well. He disappears occasionally, but I think the fact that he's lost his tail, it looks quite raw. I think he's in a bit of discomfort.
He's recovering it.
He's recovering it. He's healing. It will regrow, but a lot shorter than it did initially. And studies have shown that 50 to 70% of the slow worm actually lose their tails. To adders, to birds, to badgers, they're on the menu for an awful lot of different animals. The longest recorded living slow worm is 54 years old.
Well, that's a result then.
Absolutely.
Kirsten Mayer, Reserve Manager for Muir Dinnet National Nature Reserve. The last time I saw one, I'm trying to remember, I think I was going out Mount Keene, and unfortunately it was dead, but it was the most gorgeous bronze colour. You know, when bronze gets that weathered colour?
Yeah, just beautiful wee things, but I mean, it must be absolutely baking hot in there. Mm. Hey, very quickly, Bruce Connolly's been in touch, Memories of Loch Tay. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm sitting in my balcony here in Beijing, trying to do some work, but listening to the programme. The mention of Loch Tay and the wonderful sounds of the Corries brings back great memories of Perthshire and Loch Tay and the Corries playing in Glasgow City Halls. Thanks for a great way to spend the weekend and to relax on a Saturday afternoon. That's cheers, Bruce in Beijing.
Catherine Jarvis from Starport on Severn in Worcestershire said, I've really enjoyed the programme this morning, especially hearing about the John O'Groats Trail. My husband Neil's currently walking from Land's End to John O'Groats and will be walking the trail in a few weeks' time, and found your midweek podcast really interesting. Having completed the West Highland and Great Glen Ways myself, this one's on my bucket list too. I am beginning to think we should do it.
It's beginning to happen. Yeah. Well, mystery birds. A lot of people got this right, disappointingly. Margaret Campbell got it right. Rob Parkinson got it right. Lyndon Edsel, Gillian Balerno. She heard them in Toronto. Stuart Cameron and Leaven and Cathy Foley, Willie the Farmer, Karen and Shetland, Fiona and Black Craig, Janet and Perth, and Steve Chadwick from Suffolk all got it right.
And Scott Matheson and Stirling says, God darn it. Your clue about the Vatican means, taking a second bite of the cherry, that it must be the Northern Cardinal. So again, he adds, this feels a bit like limping over the finish line. That doesn't matter, Scott. You got there. That's the important thing.
No, I think you failed miserably, Scott, but nice. Thanks for trying.
The clip originally came from listener Graham in Dallas, Texas, and he said...
Yeah, it's a nice-looking orangey-red colour with the reputation of being fierce when it comes to territory.
And as an aside, he added, next week I'll be in Northwest Province in Canada, far above the Arctic Circle, working on a diamond mine.
Oh, goodness
I will
me.
Be listening to you from there. Well, get him.
It was the 13th of May, the year 1607. Three ships, the Susan Constant, the Godspeed, and the Discovery, lay in the bay of what was to become Jamestown, peacefully at anchor. That month, 104 English men and boys had arrived in North America to establish the first permanent English settlement in the country. The first president of the new Virginia colony, Edward Maria Winfield, was charged with making the colony flourish and to create a new home and a new beginning. But they struggled in this new land, a land of opportunity, but a land of challenge. Drinking stagnant water resulted in disease, and a lack of food led some to starvation. But many delighted in this land. It would take 10 years before the Virginia Tobacco Company would recruit almost 100 women to join the new colony. And so in the meantime, they watched in awe at the wildlife of this virgin land. Relations with the Native Americans were strained, but some learned the language and some the traditions and the mythology of those who had lived in this landscape since before the recording of time. Amongst the new species the settlers encountered was a bird that somehow reminded them of home, of the religions they had left behind and the rituals so important to many across Europe. A medium-sized songbird which would go on to become the state bird of Virginia and many other states as well. A strong, powerful beak, a slash of black across the face, an amazing crest, a call of great beauty, and most distinctive of all, a plumage of the brightest red. A red reminiscent of the robes of scarlet and the cap of the cardinals of the Roman Catholic faith they'd left behind. Indeed, when collected, these delightful birds do resemble a procession of the leaders of the Roman faith. Beloved throughout the Americas, the call is a symbol of love and faith. In Cherokee mythology, the cardinal is believed to be the daughter of the sun. In a time before time, the land went dark after the daughter of the sun was slain. The young men of the tribe were instructed by the ancients who gathered by the fire to go to the land of ghosts and retrieve the daughter of the sun. After enduring many challenges, they finally came to the land of ghosts, and there, deep in a cave, was a box containing the light of the world. As they returned with the locked box, they heard a faint sound, a sound of wailing. One young man put his ear to the wood and heard a faint voice calling for air. I'm dying. Unsettled by her wailing, the young man took his hatchet and broke open the wooden casket. Immediately, a small red bird flew out, singing with the joy of freedom, the happiness of life, and the return to her land, her people, to her father, the sun. Immediately, the sun smiled, and there was light on this land once more. In another legend, the cardinal is seen as a matchmaker between two lonely people. One day, the red bird became friends with a lonely maiden who had everything she needed to keep and satisfy her mate, but she couldn't find one. For a long time, the bird listened to the sadness in the maiden's voice as she expressed a longing for a partner. One day in his travels, the red bird met a brave man who also sadly spoke of his failure to find a maiden to love. The red bird then led the brave man to the maiden's cabin and flew to a safe distance where he watched them fall in love. And this is why cardinals are the bird of love and romance. It's believed if you're single and you see a cardinal, romance is in your near future. At the same time, if you're in a relationship and a cardinal crosses your path, it's said to be a reminder to honour your partner and remember the romance that brought you together. And the cardinal does walk the walk. Monogamous as a rule, and a male cardinal will bring food to his mate while she sits on the nest, offering it to her in a gentle, kiss-like gesture. And they remain as faithful pairs till the end of their days.
I have to say, I was completely thrown off kilter by the medieval rendition of Smoke on the Water.
Yeah, it was kind of genius, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And have any of your stories ever lacked a maiden?
No, it's compulsory.
It's compulsory.
And you have to have the ancients, and it has to be in a time before time.
Yes, indeed, beloved. Yeah, Ian Archibald in Edinburgh got it right. Heather from Linlithgow, Colin and Mary Abercrombie and Dunblane, George Smiley, East Lothian, Malcolm from Creef, Lyndon, Pete St. Cyrus, Roddy and Sandra and Inch, Walter Burns and Victoria from Edinburgh. Nancy from Mill says she got it was right, a cardinal. Lovely birds, which I've seen in Texas where my son lives. Hmm. So, good on them. And this came in too from, say, Adam Watson and Angus. Glad to hear you're having fun out in the water. I've been meaning to email to see if you're going to have a row and a skiff at Broughty Ferry at the Royalty Yacht Club. Well, wouldn't actually rule the idea out, Adam. Keith near Kemney, coming back to the Golden Eye and Loch Kinnord, I was waiting for Ewan to imitate its call like he does with the eiderduck.
Ooh.
Maybe it's... No. You know, he doesn't want you to imitate an eiderduck. He wants you to imitate a golden eye.
OK, stand by and wait to be amazed.
Oh. Yeah, fine.
It's kind of like I really don't want squeaky pencil sharpener, I think.
Quite possibly. So, thankfully, that's it from us this week. Don't forget our new Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon. And our midweek podcast, which features a programme I made a couple of years ago up in a place called The Secret Howth in the Cairngorms, which is lovely. Until the next time, from all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.